Welcome to the Bicast, a podcast for the bisexual community. Bi Book Club time again, and today we are highlighting a brand new book by Amy Leibowitz Mitchell called Lower Education. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, we're really happy to have you here. This is a great book. I absolutely adore it. I have to confess, I've made it to chapter 9, but John actually finished it last night, so yay.
This morning, at about 2. So, I didn't think it was going to be such a dense book in terms of, like, really having to read it. You know, sometimes I skim a little bit, but I couldn't skim this book. It was a good book. That was your first compliment.
Yeah, that was what I ran into too. I couldn't like skim through. It has a lot of detail that you need to just pay attention to. So yeah, great book.
Oh, well, thanks. So, I'm glad you guys liked it.
Yeah.
So Amy, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, I am a mostly stay-at-home mom and author, and I'm also a freelance editor. I'm from Western New York, and I have 2 kids. I have a son who is 11, and he goes to public school, and I have a daughter who's 9, and she is homeschooled, which is it's a little unusual, but she'll be actually going to school in a couple of years. And my background is actually in nursing. Not in writing. And I have worked in the educational system. So I was a school nurse for about 4 years. I've been a hospital nurse. And I also have a degree in health education. So, yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, we do have that in common, too. I was a nurse for many years, mostly, visiting nurse, hospice kind of stuff. But, yeah. Yeah.
That's
cool.
I would say background in health education, it would be great to have more people in our community interpret all these studies that come out in English.
Oh, yeah.
In English, yes.
Yes. Yep. Research ease is a little hard to understand.
It is. We do have a great researcher who collects stuff for us, but it's still, when I look at some of the stats and stuff like that, I just go, I don't understand. This is a great book. Yeah. This is a great book. An interesting look into our educational system, to say the least. Mm-hmm. I saw that you explained that the characters are made up. This is kind of thing does happen in reality. And I actually did not realize this, but I actually heard a piece on NPR about charter schools. I was just shocked. I mean, absolutely shocked. So, yeah. So what inspired you to write the book?
Well, my husband's a teacher, and now we have kids who are going through the educational system, and one of the new things that they've implemented is teacher evaluations. A lot of that is based on state testing and how good your results are, and how good really are the results on a state test. How much does that really tell us about what a student learns and how far they've come between September and June? So there was that, and then at some point I had started reading about charter schools and had learned that charter schools are beginning to be like the new version of privatization. So corporations will come in and they'll take over schools. These companies are paid to run schools. And what happens is that by the way New York does it, if a school is failing, if not enough students are passing the test, the school has some really not so great options, like firing half their teachers or bringing in a charter company to privatize the school. So that really does happen. And I found myself feeling very frustrated by that. And that wasn't actually the original story was something an entirely different plot. But when I started reading about that, I said, you know, that's a great direction to take this story, that rather than what I had originally planned, taking it in the direction of what happens with these charter schools and privatization by companies that maybe don't even really have anything to do with education at all.
Right. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, I'm going to move up the question since we're talking about it. Yeah, so we're already talking about charter schools. How is that going on in rural towns like the fictional one in lower education? And where is the privatization happening in New York State?
Actually, most of the privatization is happening in city schools. I chose to use a rural setting because that was the setting for the story. The story is actually a sort of a modern retelling of the Pied Piper, but in real life, most of the privatization happens in city schools. Those are the schools that are most noticeable. They're the ones that have a lot of funding funneled into them by the state. So a lot of times what happens is you get these city schools that are going downhill. They're in poor neighborhoods. They're in places that have a lot of other issues. And the state will say, yeah, you're not really keeping up with the tests, so we're going to close your school. And in order to get the money to stay open, they'll privatize, but then people have to pay to go to the school, and the charter schools aren't necessarily a good option. Like I said, they're not run necessarily by people with education experience. They're run by corporations. So, but it is mostly actually an urban problem.
Oh, I was going to say, I've got two relatives in the Rochester area, and, you know, in that part of the world, it's all about what school district you're in.
Yes.
You know, neighboring school districts, one is a lot more wealthy, and they have huge property taxes, and they have, like, the most amazing schools in the world, and right next door, it's a poor area, and the schools aren't really well-funded.
Yes.
And, of course, you know, in Rochester, you know, there's a city school system, too, and there's, because any city, there's going to be needs that are a lot greater than in suburban and rural areas, especially suburban areas. One of the things that I think I kind of caught in the book is, you know, another reality of education is people coming from different language backgrounds. And
yes.
It's really difficult when you have a school system that is trying to teach English as a second language, as
yes.
well as to show improvement in those students on these tests. You know, I live in an urban area. It's very diverse, and you know, our school would be really great in terms of really teaching kids a lot of lessons, but would always fall behind in the test scores because of the number of languages they were teaching in and teaching English.
Yeah, that happens here too. My family happens to live, we're in the suburbs, but our neighborhood is very diverse. So our school district does have a lot of non-English speaking students, and a lot of people from a lot of different parts of the world. My particular neighborhood has a lot of people from the Middle East, but other neighborhoods have a lot of people from various other places in the world. There's a lot of Spanish speaking communities in my town. So yeah, that's a huge problem.
Here in Portland, we have some great programs that are very language inclusive that are really doing quite well, some of the schools, so it's really great. But I can see where this privatization can cause for a great amount of corruption, and the goal of education gets lost because the goal of making money is more important.
Yes.
And I love the way you have presented this with our character, who I feel really bad for him in a way, because he really had a kind of dealt a royal deals to growing up as far as morality.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, he wants to do well. He does. But I'm not sure he has the tools to do that. So I'm hoping by the time I finish the book, things he has come to a place where he's building better tools.
Spoiler alert, it does have a happy ending.
Okay, good. I'm glad. But there's a lot of other things going on here that are just, you know, great. You know, talking about sexual identities and growing up queer and dealing with that. And I just love the book. It's so real life. These people are so real. But you've also talked that these are not really based on real characters or real people.
Yeah,
actually,
exactly.
You said it was, yeah. So, but was there anything that you actually kind of based it off of?
I did. Well, some of the characters, many of them are kind of amalgams of people I know in real life. So, for example, Danny, the school secretary, is a mix of a whole lot of different people that I know who are just these fabulous, wonderful women who are moms and they're working. And so, yeah, so she's kind of a mix of a bunch of different people that I know in real life. Actually, Finn, the main character, is based on a book character that I particularly love, and the whole story, which I don't want to totally give everything away because I would really love if at least one reader would pick up on my not so subtle tribute to one of my favorite movie musicals, but he is based on the main character from both the book I love and this movie musical. Not entirely, but
oh, I think I know which one it is.
Yeah. My references are so not subtle. The town names, the people names, they all come from it, and which is also actually a nod to that particular movie in which the person who wrote the musical did exactly the same thing. So that was my...
Oh.
And there's a point in the book toward the end of it, about maybe two-thirds or three-quarters of the way through, where I literally quote a line from the movie. So by the time someone gets there, if they haven't picked up on it then, it's because they didn't ever watch it.
Well, I can't wait to see if I'm right. So I'm not going to give it away, but yeah, that's fantastic. I'm sorry, John, go ahead. I'm cutting you off.
Yeah, that's okay. I was going to say, like, that one of the things I really love about this book is, I mean, it's a bit of a it's romance, but it's really about real people. And, you know, Finn is described as being pretty hot. The romances, the relationships in the book are really about real people coming together in a small town where everybody knows each other. But I found that really a nice kind of change of pace.
Yeah, it was interesting to me because I always just say, it's a romance, but it's not a traditional one, and Amazon didn't actually classify it as a romance. They classified it as literary, so I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, well, it is kind of a romance, but if it's talking about romance in our real lives, like
yeah.
Danny's relationship with Vic, you know, that's more common than people think it is. But you know, they don't talk about that, you know, does that kind of friendship with someone, and I love that, I really do. I mean, and it's very these people are very honest with each other about things, and
yeah,
it's really kind of cool. It's very cool to see that.
Yeah.
All right, so here's my heavy question, not really heavy, but yeah. You and I have had several great conversations on Facebook about the word bisexual in literature.
Yes.
And I'm going to tell you right away that I searched for it and you did put it in there.
I did.
But I haven't actually read the whole conversation between Michael and I don't really know too much. I kind of avoided it because I hadn't got to that point yet. I just want to check it was in there. But, yeah, it's in there. But it looks very appropriate to what the conversation was because Michael is really struggling.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and, you know, I appreciate that. But it is hard to write that kind of thing in without it changing the flavor of the story. But I do believe it can be possible because, you know, people are gay or lesbian, and that's talked about, and it doesn't actually change the construct of the story anymore.
Right.
It's very normal. So my goal is that someday we can do that with the word bisexual, too. But I don't think by avoiding it, it's going to happen.
No. And one of my peeves is that I'm also a book reviewer. So, and one of my peeves when I read a book is there's a lot of bi erasure, particularly in gay stories. I don't see it quite as much in lesbian stories. Those tend to actually be a little bit less coming out kinds of stories. But I, first of all, wanted to avoid mostly a coming-out story because what I see a lot of is this character who's presumed straight all of a sudden meets Mr. Hottie, and now he's gay. So, I hate it. I hate it.
There's no nuance, and
it's always this struggle of, but I'm really straight, until I'm not. And so I said, I really need to avoid that, and actually, I didn't necessarily set out to say I'm going to create a bisexual character. He just was. It wasn't a question. It was just, who he is. So for me, that was kind of interesting looking thing, going, oh, well, you know, I don't have to think about this. That's just part of who this person is. But that was a really big struggle for Alex, who does, in his mind, there is not really any such thing. So that was kind of... It's not a huge part of the story, but it is part of the story. And I felt that in using the word bisexual at least once in the story, that would reinforce some of my own feelings about not wanting to have bisexuality erased in our stories. So that was why I did that. But at the same time, the characters who are talking, Finn's very comfortable using the word bisexual. Michael is not. And he even alludes to that and says he doesn't like labels. And I think a lot of that is, you know, if you get burned once, somebody tells you that's not a real thing, it can be really hard to feel like you want to own that identity. And he's not really ready to own that identity.
And this is a very typical thing that happens. This is very much reality. And, you know, Alice's reaction is a reality, too. And I'm glad you put that in there, because it is that reinforcing of the fact there is no real bisexual. You either, the one drop rule, you're either gay or straight, is one of our biggest problems, you know, in the gay community, especially. And we do get a lot of those stories. I was straight, but now I'm gay, you know, all of a sudden. And there's no talk about us or the fact that sexuality is so fluid.
And also a sub story is that there is a school bully, and at least some of that bullying is really about orientation.
Yes. Yeah.
Because they do pick you out.
They do. And some of the bullying is not just about orientation, but it's about class and race. This particular bully has targeted someone who is not white, and not wealthy, and not straight. So he's picked up on pretty much everything he could possibly pour into beating up this kid over. But at the same time, not everybody in this town feels that that's an appropriate reaction, fortunately. So.
Yeah, and you touch on so many things that are reality that need to be talked about, that don't get talked about.
Yeah.
You know, and bullying is one of our biggest problems, and, you know,
well, it's also power relationships, because, you know, he comes from a family with power.
Yeah.
Yes.
Everybody gets in trouble but him.
Yes.
That's very common.
Yeah, and actually the parent in that situation, he's the head of the school board, and he is actually based on a real, not necessarily on a real person, but on a real situation. I don't think it'll spoil too much to say this, but there's a scene where they're in the school board meeting, and he makes a comment about how he's going to be sending his kids not to the privatized public school, but to a Catholic school two towns over, and in a board meeting at the state education department. Yeah. Education commissioner actually talked about how he wanted his kids to get a good education, so they were going to private school.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So the character is not based on Commissioner King. I need to say that. The character is not based on Commissioner King, but his words echo what our state commissioner said.
Oh, that's so unbelievable.
I had to listen to the board meeting 3 or 4 times in order to get that scene right.
Oh, we don't have privilege. Oh, my gosh. I can't believe it. That's it. Well, that's incredible.
Yeah, I also like the idea that this is a central school, and, you know, it's one school for the entire town. And privatizing it, turning it into a charter, would basically close the only public school. That's really kind of scary.
Yes. I'm not sure that could really happen. I suspect that if a rural town was truly failing, they might try to find a way to send the kids to a school at another town nearby. But that was why, because I know there's a little bit of tension when the situation that I created at the end of the story for how they resolve the issue might be something that some teachers or some other educators might look at and say, I don't know about that. Is that really a good solution? I won't give it away for those who haven't read the book.
Sure.
But
thank you.
But in fact, if you have a town with just one school, there are limited options if the school is going to close. So they would have been severely restricted in what they could do about the problem.
Well, you know, in the rural area, because we have a lot of rural areas here, these are not wealthy people, and they cannot afford to, and there's a lot of people that would just, their education would suffer so much if they closed the only public school. And, you know, busing kids off to another school in another town, these are 30, 40 mile trips sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, this is not good, you know.
Yes.
And a lot of kids have just been left by the wayside.
Yes.
It's scary.
Yeah, I know people who live in rural towns who homeschool because the bus ride is nearly an hour.
Well, and then you put in where we are, especially, you know, during the wintertime, busing 30 miles to school, that's, you know, you could be taking your life doing that. The snow is so bad and everything else.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. You have a kid on the bus for an hour and a half, 2 hours every day, 3 hours every day, plus the school. You get burnt out kids. That's a lot.
Yeah, it
really
is.
That's a lot to deal with.
Yeah.
Yeah. All righty. Did you get everything, John? What do you think?
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit more about charter schools, and I think we haven't exhausted it yet. Amy, if you want to talk a little more.
Sorry, I was going to say, I can only speak to what I've personally seen. They were attempting to open a charter school in Rochester. I don't think anything's ever really come of that. One of the bigger problems with that is where the money comes from, where it's going, who's benefiting from it. Companies like Pearson. Pearson's a huge company, and they provide all of the state tests. And if a company like Pearson is benefiting from a charter school, that sort of calls into question what their practices are in creating the tests that could lead to having to close schools or change them to private schools. So it really is.
Yes,
there's a lot of corruption there.
Yeah, definitely a conflict of interest. Here, I mean, Washington, D.C. was actually kind of forced into charter schools by the federal government some years back. And my county, PG, we're the 17th largest system in the country. And so far, we've not had a lot of charter schools. And the few that we've had weren't really privatized schools. They were attempts by nonprofits and the university system, et cetera, to create different model schools. And none of them so far have really had much success. You know, I think one of the problems that we have is, and I think it came into the book, was that art aren't valued as language and math are. Because the testing and the Common Core will hopefully maybe deal with some of this, but the No Child Left Behind testing was all about like meeting English and math standards. And so everything else goes by the wayside. And in that, the school, it really is teaching kids a kind of a broad education. And, you know, that's the first thing the privatized company is going to get rid of is all the arts. And it's real. I think one of the biggest pieces of this book is just how much the arts are valued among, especially the main characters, but really among the community. It's a community kind of building thing of involving these kids in the arts.
I grew up in Penfield, New York, which is on the east side of Rochester, and my community growing up, that was a big part of it. We had sports programs, and they were fantastic, but mostly we had a lot of arts programs, so I play the violin, and I grew up playing in my school orchestra. I played in the school band. I played French horn for a few years. I wasn't very good, and I sang in the choir at school. So for me, music was huge, but art was just as big. We had lots and lots of art classes and art studios, and I had friends who did jewelry making. I had friends who did pottery. So there was a very big emphasis on the arts, and the community rallied around that. So every time it came up in the budget and they would say, we'd like to make some cuts to the arts programs, please, the community would just go get up in arms, and people would come out in droves. Even people whose kids weren't really involved necessarily would just come out and say, you cannot cut our arts programs. And now our family lives in Greece, New York, and the arts programs here are outstanding, and there's so much available for kids to do. There's so much. My son is having trouble choosing which art programs he wants to be involved in. So that really has been a big part of my life, a big part of New York. So I wanted to emphasize that because who are the teachers that most of us remember best? It's not necessarily going to be, maybe for people who love their English classes and their math classes, they'll remember those teachers. But most of us are going to remember our music teachers or our art teachers, people who poured more into our lives than just some information that we spit back out on a test. And I think, you know, I think the same thing is actually true with sports too. These are not people who are just involved on the basis of you happen to be in class with me. These are people who have taken much, much more time to really be part of their students' lives. And I think if we get rid of that, that's going to hurt all the things that they just want to test you on too. It's going to hurt the language arts. It's going to hurt the math programs because kids who are actually overall do better. So, yeah, that's my little I'll get down on my soapbox
now. It's actually true that, and it's true, that's who I remember is my arts teachers. I remember them, you know, very little about the other classes. You know, and that's how our minds are developed. We can't just sit and take tests. You don't learn that way. That is not how you learn. I mean, I'm a great tester. I can sit down before a test, go over the material, and memorize all the right answers, test on it, get absolutely perfect grades, and not remember a thing about it, you know, a half hour later. I'm done. It's out of my mind. You know, and that's not learning as far as I'm concerned. Learning is, you know, exploring and growing and really finding out information and learning how to learn. And I don't think you can do that just taking tests.
No, you really can't. And I think that was the other thing, too, is that as I wrote this story, I realized these are people who want to make learning broader. They want to make it bigger than just spitting it back out on a test. So some of the things the school has experimented with, are they so great? Maybe, maybe not. The chicken scenario was pretty similar to one that happened with my son in his fourth grade class. They actually raised chickens for a while. So,
yeah.
Did it work well? The kids had a great time. My son could probably tell us a lot about chickens now.
Yeah. I know we had a chicken experiment at our school too, but our teacher actually brought in embryos that we cracked open eggs at different processes. It was like for science class. And mostly what I remember about it is I was really grossed out and didn't want to eat the eggs for a long time.
Wow.
Really avoided them. And you know, here is an embryo at 6 weeks or whatever, 2 weeks, and it's like, oh, gross, there's a little beak and everything, ew.
Oh, boy.
And maybe chicken isn't the best one.
Yeah. Yeah, we did one when I was in high school where we actually had to, inject chickens with hormones to see how it affected their growth. Which sounds so, I mean, I look back on it and think, wow, that is just so cruel. But I mean, I remember it pretty vividly.
I know, all those science classes were just, you know, and I'm a nurse, so I don't really bother, things don't really bother me. But I never could get past, you know, dissecting worms and pinning them. It was not the dissecting part, it was the pinning them to things.
Yeah,
bugged me.
Yeah, yep.
It's like, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Anyway. So John had a question about the name.
I know upstate. You know, I know lots of New York, and I know there's a Peru, New York, but I saw a Peru spelled O-O, and so that kind of just clicked me a little bit. Of course, some of the other towns are named properly. My partner's from Oneonta, so I know how to spell Oneonta, and I know SUNY there.
Yeah, Peru is, I think, up by Watertown, and this is set down in the southern tier. So, but I wanted the name, but then when my beta readers were going through it, one of my betas said, you know, there's actually a real Peru, New York, and I said, oh, shoot, because I wanted the name. So I just changed the spelling. Know this, there are multiple towns in New York with the same name near us. But there's a Charlotte down in the southern tier, too. I was unaware of that. Uh-huh. So I probably could have just kept the name the same, confuse anyone who was actually from New York.
Yeah.
So whereas some of the other things in there are actual real places. So places in Albany are real. The various places in or near Albany that I reference are real places. Oneonta's real. Wegmans is a real grocery store in New York and other places.
So, you know, I have education system. One we pulled out of the public education system, and it is that I think one of the problems that we have is that we don't have enough different kinds of educational systems. There's a few magnets. There's a few Montessori schools, et cetera. And my oldest was in a science and tech program, which is kind of the jewel crown of the county. So, you know, he was a great test taker, and he was, you know, the typical student who can pass all those tests. Our other one was pretty much done with elementary school in fourth grade and let us know it. So we actually have him in a Sudbury school that's actually a pretty good way. I mean, it's a small school, so we have a local carpool, and it's about a 45-minute drive, 50-minute doing all the drop-offs and pickups. But that's one of the things that I think when charter schools came in, the idea was that they were going to replace kind of magnet programs. In some places, they've kind of done that. But, you know, the school in the story is kind of like doing just the opposite of, you know, taking a school that has a broad curriculum, and the goal of the magnet, or the goal of the charter coming in, is to cut it into just passing the test, which is the opposite of how you provide a good education in this country.
Yeah, I mean,
the history of charter schools is that they should have been schools, and some charter schools are even owned by smaller, not corporations, but like a church could own a charter school, even mm-hmm. as long as they're not providing necessarily specifically religious education, they could have a charter. Exactly. There's all different ways to do it. Charters have a long, long, very good history, but that's not how they're currently being used, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So then the thing is there's a lot of kids that don't fit in, don't get the right kind of attention and proper education in public schools because of their, for whatever reason, their own, I don't like to say learning disability because that doesn't sound accurate to me, but they need better attention or a different kind of attention and different process of learning than they can get in public schools. And if we start losing that, but they can get in the magnet schools and the other schools, that's pretty scary. And it's so expensive.
Yeah.
It's so incredibly expensive. Like I said, kids get left by the wayside, you know, and do terrible in public schools because they don't get the proper kind of care they need.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah, I have two kids who have learning needs, and that's one reason why we kept our younger one at home to homeschool for a while. My older one actually does better in a public school, but, you know, there's still some things that are struggles, and would he be better off in a smaller classroom? Probably. He would probably be better off in a smaller space in some ways, and in other ways not so much. So it really is, it's a balance, but it's one that parents should be able to make more of a choice on as opposed to everything just being forced on you.
Exactly. We had, like I said, we have some great programs here in Portland. Or my granddaughter actually got the kind of, you know, attention she needed. They put him in a special program and went through public school, you know. And, you know, she was, like, learning Chinese and all these different languages, and one of them, yeah, I was part of the school, you know, because they had such a diverse group of children from all over the place that they, you know, it was part of the language thing. They were learning all these languages along with the other kids learning English. It was great.
Yeah.
It was like, yeah, I was really, of course, she only went there a couple of years, but that was pretty cool. I mean, you know, that kind of exposure is something that stays with you forever.
Oh, yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, I was going to say that. What makes it hard is parents in the school system, all the acronyms, right? When you're dealing with the education, dealing with an entirely different education language, which is entirely made up of acronyms and performance metrics and things like that. And it makes it very difficult for parents sometimes just to understand what's going on. I think in some cases it's actually a way that the system tries to protect its own and itself from oversight from the parents. that, you know, you just don't understand the, you know, AYPs and those kind of things. And here are the MSAs, which are going away for Common Core. And it just like you get stuck in this whole set of acronyms and, you know, having a kid that had an IEP and understanding the process of that and
yes.
In which rights are always being violated under it, and not being able to deal with it when your kids' rights are being violated under their own, you know, under the school's own recommendations.
Yeah,
sounds like smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, it is a difficult thing to navigate.
Yeah, when I was a school nurse, I actually did some advocacy for students because under the law, students who have medical needs also qualify for 504 plans. As if they have anything related to their medical needs or any specific diagnosis, if any of it needs to have something happen during the school day, they qualify for a 504, which is the Americans with Disabilities Act. They qualify for a 504 plan. So I did some advocacy, and, yeah, administration was not real happy with me at all for telling parents to stand up and advocate for their kids. But the teachers were all like, yes, do this, please, because teachers, unfortunately, don't get too far with trying to advocate for their own students sometimes. It's difficult.
Yeah, Aldis had a 504 plan. He had a bone marrow transplant, and I'll tell you, in that year we felt like, you know, like it was kind of hard to advocate when we had a sick child, but you know, we really felt abandoned by the system that year. You know, he wound up having to take an extra year instead of being really tutored while he was sick, and you know, just really felt like, you know, here's a really sick kid and the system isn't like dealing with that. You know, that's what happened.
Okay. Yeah.
So on a 504 plan, I'm not familiar with this because my kids didn't get any of that benefit, but my granddaughter is actually a diabetic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, okay, so they would be aware of that at her school. Is that correct? They are aware of it at school. She has to go in and you know,
yeah,
do things with the nurse and everything like that. So what does a 504 plan do?
It provides for students to have their needs met in ways that maybe fall outside of typical alterations in their education. So, for example, my son actually does have a 504 plan, which for him, it's for his ADHD, and he's pretty open about it. So he's, you know, we have permission from my son. I don't like to talk about my kids without their permission, but I will talk about my son because he has given his permission for that. He has a 504 for his ADHD, and what it provides for him is he gets extra time on tests because he needs to be redirected and refocused sometimes. He is allowed to stand up and move around during testing time, which normally they are not allowed. He is usually in a separate room for testing so that he and the other students are not distracting each other. He actually has some of these same things during class. He doesn't have so much a problem with his focus as much as his excess energy and the fact that when he has to channel his energy to sit for a long period of time, like for a test, he just can't. So his 504 provides for that. We had students when I worked as a school nurse who had, for example, they had asthma. So their 504s would include provisions for their phys ed classes. Some of them had modified phys ed if they had asthma that was worsened by physical activity.
Mm-hmm.
We had a number of kids who had 504s because they had ADHD. Sometimes kids with certain types of learning disabilities that would not necessarily need an IEP might then have a 504. So you might have a student who has something like dysgraphia, where they have trouble with writing, where their 504, they wouldn't necessarily need an IEP because it's not an overall whole picture of a student with needs. It's one specific thing. So they might have, say, a text to typing computer program.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So it provides for very, very specific needs when the student does not have an overall need for their whole education to be modified in some way.
Right. I think my granddaughter had she had trouble with the testing part because her ADHD was conceptual. She was more verbal than written, and so she was. She had most of hers was done verbally, which was great because she tested great then, you know. But, you know, I think that's what you're talking about, right?
Yes, that's exactly it. Yes.
All right. Alrighty, fantastic. This is great. Well, this is a great book because it covers so much great stuff. I mean, you know, our educational system and, you know, sexual orientation and the things that we need to go through in our life, romance a little bit.
Yeah, I'm always surprised at the reactions that I'm getting. Everybody seems to pick up on different things in the story. I honestly wrote it because I wanted to write that story, and I'm still feeling sort of surprised and overwhelmed by the response it's gotten.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's great. Keep writing. We'll wait for your next book.
Expect
it in 3 months.
Deadline is
it may be about that long. I have to send the next one into my publisher. So
righty, John, you ready to wrap up?
Yeah All the links will be provided on the website,
and this is where you get a chance to plug anything new that you want to do. Is there anything you'd like to add, Amy?
You know, I don't think I have anything extra to add. The links are on the website. So, you know, I currently have a couple of stories that are available on my website, and there will be a new one up this week. So
yay!
Yeah.
Awesome. Fantastic. All right, I want to remind everybody that you are not wrong, you are not broken, and you are not alone. You are a human being, and you are bisexual. And I just had the best time. Thank you so much, Amy.
No problem. This is great.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay. Don't hang up, Amy.
Okay, not hanging up.
Yeah, I don't know why that's not in there, but I used to say, don't hang up at the bottom. I just want to double check and make sure. Is there anything you wanted to add?
I don't know. That was really fun.
Yeah, it is fun. I told you, we have a good time. Yeah. So I'm a pretty good editor, so everything's going to sound fantastic. Right, John?
Yeah, will.
Yeah.
Awesome. I know I told people before, and I'm like, everybody's going to hear my horrible Rochester accent, because when I'm a little nervous, it comes out more.
No, you sounded great, and we all have accents, even me. I have one. Yeah. I mean, I always thought I didn't have one, but we always think that, right?
Yes.
So, no, you sounded just fine.
Excellent.
I usually say it takes about 4 days because it depends on what's going on with my life. It'll be up sooner than that because it's pretty calm right now. But as soon as it's up, I will let you know, okay?
Excellent. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, because my publisher, I have a group with the other authors with my publisher. So I was saying, guess what I'm doing this week? So, of course, they're all anxious to hear it because, you know, this is sort of publicity for them, too.
Oh, are you? And is this to an independent publisher?
It is.
Let's plug your publisher. I lost you there. Are you there?
Oh, I'm still here.
Okay. I like to plug the independent publishers because they need as much help as we do.
Oh, yeah.
So if we could just talk about them for just a second, and I'll put it in.
Okay.
So who is your publisher?
My publisher is Supposed Crimes, and I'm actually under the Acquitted label, but the publisher is Supposed Crimes.
Awesome, and we'll put that link up for them too, okay? So let's all support. Let's support our independents, you guys.
I can send you the link if you need it.
Would you? That'd be fine. I could look it up, but it'd be easier for me if you do.
Yeah, I'll just email it to you or message you or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's been great working with a small publisher, and we're like a little family, so we all kind of know each other now, and that's great.
Yay!
Yeah,
all right.
She published.
Oh, it is that,
yeah,
you know, so many of the
mostly
books.
Lesbian stories.
Okay. But you know, most of the great books coming out these days aren't being reviewed by the New York Times, and the number of bookstores going down to just a few. We're kind of fortunate. We just had a new bookstore open up in D.C. and Busboys and Poets, which is a local restaurant chain, has little bookstores, mostly political books, but you know, little bookstores. So, you know, hopefully that is coming back again, because you know, in the old days, which is like last century, it was really the booksellers who promoted really great books and found authors and made sure that people could, you know, people knew who they were and read them. And like when you go, you know, we used to go into our local bookstore, and she is a really a big name in terms of children's books as a librarian. And you know, of course, the first time we heard about Harry Potter was in her store before anybody knew what it was. And of course, in terms of the doll authors, you know, like she was promoting authors that we weren't hearing about. And that kind of is missing these days in Amazon,
yeah,
where, you know, like a big author will hire a bunch of reviews or a publisher will, or, you know, to kind of, or a big company will go and make a book a bestseller overnight because they've got the money to promote it.
Right.
We grew up.
All books get lost in that mix.
Yeah. We grew up in bookstores when I was a kid, in libraries and bookstores, in the small independent ones. And these are people that knew what was going on, and they knew the books, even the odd different ones. And, you know, we got exposed to a lot of great things, and we had there's a rapport with the book owner, the bookstore owner.
Yeah.
And that's missing now. I mean, we have Palace Books here, which most of those people, they're pretty, well, you know, articulate in some things, but it's a big, huge store. And, well, I don't even want to talk about the bisexual section, which hardly exists, but.
Yeah, you know. I was actually in Portland, last March, and so I went there. And it was a little overwhelming.
It is overwhelming, isn't it? And they try to break it up into different sections and make it a little more homey, but it's still this huge store, you know. And yeah, that kind of community thing is lost a little bit. They do fairly well, but yeah. Well, we used to hang out in the bookstores and read and read and read and in the library. You know, that was a big entertaining day for us.
My kids still love the local library. And our local library is pretty good. They actually have a lot of books by local authors and a lot of smaller books, big stuff in too. But I've noticed that they do make the effort to stock books not as maybe well-known. So especially our particular town library.
Yeah, our libraries here are really good.
I'll say,
if they don't have it, then they'll get it for you, you know.
Yeah.
I'll say, like, going through small towns in upstate and New York and the Adirondacks and such, and even New England, especially Vermont, that there are still a lot of small local bookstores in the towns. And I always remember tooling around those areas, I always love to go to those local bookstores and see the local flavor of what they're promoting, what they're selling, and, you know, and then seeing, like, really local authors being promoted, because that's not done enough.
All right, well, let's get you off the line, honey. I'll let you know as soon as this is up, okay?
And
thank you so much.
Thanks for the book.
Yeah, we can't wait for
glad
more.
You guys liked it.
All right, bye.
All right, bye.
We are Clone Dance Party, an Orphan Black intro cast.
There were so many questions that weren't answered that I was like, well, but I have to know.
Vic doesn't seem that smart. I don't know what Sarah was doing with him.
It's a real testament to the actors because I really feel like they're different people. So
yeah.
She's really doing a good job.
I totally agree, Lynette. I forget that they're the same person.
I am totally unobjective about Allison. I love that character to death.
She became my least favorite clone.
Clone Dance Party in iTunes, on Facebook, and on Twitter.
The views expressed on the Bicast do not necessarily represent those of Binet USA or the Bicast crew.
This is Saint Zero from the Headphone Bleed, and you're listening to the Bicast. Symptoms may include an open mind, sense of community, shinier hair, and whiter teeth.
Results may vary.
You can catch me every Saturday night at www.live365.com/stations/Saint Zero.
You fit back.